The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's Mad Tech Podcast. My name's Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Jen Antonio from Magnite and also board member of the Women in Programmatic Network. Hello, Jen.
Hey. Great to be here. Very excited.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. I'm also really pleased to be joined by my fellow colleague, Lindsay Rowntree, COO at ExchangeWire. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello, everyone. Lovely to be here.
It is. So I'm going to delve right in now that we've sorted out all our audio and tech issues.
There were a few.
There were a few. But the first story I'd like to kick off with is that around IAB Tech Lab introducing SDA, otherwise known as seller-defined audiences. So IAB Tech Lab has introduced a new standard called SDA, which promises to give publishers greater control over how their audience data is transacted. The technical specification was presented at the industry body's Addressability Systems Design event last week. SDA will work by allowing publishers to split their audiences into different groups based on their activity or interests, which they can share with advertisers for targeting. Unlike Google's cohort-based topics solution, SDA uses publishers' first-party audience data and not browser data to sort web users into groups. Now, the IAB Tech Lab have expressed their hope that publishers will share the rationale behind their grouping of audiences by adopting its data transparency label alongside SDA. With a high take-up rate, SDA could enable publishers to scale and monetize their audiences by facilitating buys across outlets and with the ability to add contextual labels to their content. Publishers won't need to sell their first-party data for targeting. However, this success depends wholly on adoption by all sides of programmatic. Whew, there's a lot in there. Now, Jen, I'd like to come to you first, just with, you know, a simple question like, could the post-cookie future be built on SDA?
So, yeah, this is really interesting, actually, and I think absolutely yes. I think this is a really good thing. This is a good thing because, you know, finally publishers have some direction. And it doesn't relate to Google. It's a new standard. And like you said, it gives publishers that greater control of how they kind of, you know, package up and sell those audiences. And I think that's what, you know, publishers have all been wanting, is to have that level of control. And I think that ability to be able to categorize that content is also, or those audiences is also really nice. I think it's a really good sized amount of audience segments. I think it's about 1600, which means that, you know, there's lots of granularity with that. Whereas I think with Google Topics, it's only around 30. So it's quite limited. And I think, you know, the other really smart move from the IAB actually is the fact that they are also allowing that ability to sort of customize some of those taxonomies as well. So again, giving publishers that level of sort of flexibility and also control as well. So I think, frankly, this looks like a really nice model that I think really could work. You know, it requires obviously adoption and publishers getting behind this. But, you know, this has really allowed publishers the ability to take that control and get behind this. And I think I don't think there's necessarily a huge amount of work from the publisher side, especially if they've already got a DMP in place. You know, that data is already sort of categorized, and it just probably requires a bit of mapping to those IAB segments. And there may be some sort of gaps where they might need to manually do a bit of a manual lift. But I think the key thing is here is to really, and in order to get value out of this, is making sure that publishers spend time building their first party data strategy that they have, and making sure that they have the tools and the mechanics in place so that they can actually feed all the right information through and categorize that content well. So I think it's a really, really good thing. I think also that from an SSP point of view, because obviously, you know, it does require everyone to adopt this for it to work. You've got this chicken and egg situation. So I know typically publishers will tend to sort of like maybe hold back and see who else is doing it, or, you know, if there's demand for this, then they will. So you have that chicken and egg situation. But I definitely think from an SSP point of view, they will buy into this. I mean, Magnite literally did buy into this. We bought Carbon, which, you know, is an audience management, creation and measurement company. So they 100% have, you know, they have their backing, and they really see that, you know, that this will bolster their first party solution in preparation for the deprecation of cookies, and kind of, you know, really sort of believe that this is the future of identity and addressability. So I really hope the publishers do get behind this, and really do start to adopt this, because I think it is a good thing. And I think the key thing here to remember is that, you know, this doesn't require the sharing of identifiers. So, you know.
Yeah, that's what everyone's kind of trying to work around, really, isn't it? Lindsay, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think DSPs and SSPs will buy into it?
I think they will. I feel like they should have no reason not to. I mean, you know, certainly the DSPs, from an advertiser perspective, advertisers want to be able to target audiences better. And SDA is certainly a way for them to do that, to be able to kind of have more, you know, more granular, accurate targeting, as accurate as it can be, given the nature of what SDA actually is. So I feel like DSPs would be stupid to say, no, we're not going to buy into this, because advertisers would be compelled to force them to if they had to. So I do feel like there'll be strong uptake. It's in everyone's best interests to back this. But I would say that my concerns around it, which, Jen, I'm fascinated by your thoughts on this, because you're much more, I'm from the outside looking in, you're much more embedded in kind of publisher life, you know, with Magnite, and obviously, you know, you worked at a publisher for years as well, is the seller-defined aspect and the fact that, you know, are they marking their own homework by defining these categories themselves, by defining who goes into what category? The IAB obviously kind of like encouraging them to sign up to the data transparency label, encouraging them, but they can't make them. And the data transparency label, I believe, is also self-declared. That causes challenges as well. So they're being told to declare how they came about putting somebody in said bucket, but they could lie on both counts. I'm not saying that this would necessarily happen with any of the premium publishers, but there's, you know, we have to think of the broad realm of publishers that exist in the world, from small to large, from nefarious to legitimate and premium, and how they would arrange it. So that's my first kind of question, is kind of actually, is that a cause for concern, or is it just kind of me reading too much into how this could work, and how would the IAB kind of mitigate that, I guess? And then my other concern is around kind of actually the volume of topics. Like, obviously, this came from, I read this on Morning Brew, which I think talked about it from when it was announced, and their favourite category is the one called onions/potatoes.
Yeah,
fantastic. I would love to be in the onions potatoes category.
You're busy in the tractor factory.
There you go. Yeah. I think maybe it was created just for me because of my affinity with tractors. So yeah, definitely. But I think that what's interesting for me is topics only has 30 categories. And the reason for that is so that there's no ambiguity around anybody being identified. So the broader the categories are, the less likely it is for only one person, which is obviously a bit of a strange scenario, but for one person to be entered into a category and for that person identified. The IAB have created 1600 or whatever the number, what the gender set was, and publishers could create more. And so is there a danger that actually you could make them too granular, so you could end up having people be identified? And also, these segments, could there be data commingling? So if a segment is uploaded and targetable via a DSP, could that be connected with another kind of audience segment or another kind of targeting type, combine them together? Could you actually identify somebody through that? I mean, that's a common concern with any kind of targeting aspect, not just SDA. But they're all the things I think, you know, I'm naturally a negative person, and they're all the things that came into my head.
Yeah, well, I think actually on the segment size and being able to identify users if they're too granular, I think there may be some restrictions on how small those can be, so that might help mitigate that. But I think on the marking your own homework piece, that's quite interesting actually, because I mean, you could argue that pubs could be doing that now, you know, with the way they're already categorizing that content. And I think really the proof is in the pudding, because, you know, if that information has been passed across in the bid request and buyers are seeing that it's not performing in the way that it needs to, they will just, you know, target away, or they just won't bid on that. So I think, you know, there is a responsibility for publishers to not go too gung-ho and, you know, bolster up and inflate those segments, because ultimately they won't perform and you'll have other publishers that will perform. And so they'll just shift that spend there. So I think that's maybe, you know, what will help publishers to kind of, you know, make sure that content is accurately categorized.
When I was, you mentioning commingling there, Lindsay, when I was reading around this, one thing, I mean, don't get me wrong, listeners, there were a lot of things that weren't clear to me because I'm not an expert in there here, but it was around, why is prebid.js a prerequisite? And there was a question in particular around, is it ensuring there is no commingling of identifiers with SDA metadata? And I'm guessing, and I'm keen to know if either of you can kind of add some context to this, that pre-bid first-party data object provides a seamless way to kind of set and pass SDA values within what they call the new SegTax community extension, which they developed with OpenRTB. So therefore, it's not impossible to do bespoke mapping to the community extension, but it's kind of far less turnkey. And that kind of perhaps feeds into what you were talking about, Jen, then as well, in terms of the manual elements. And depending on the volume of that, what kind of challenges might that bring into play? Am I making any sense?
You're making sense, but I don't know if I...
Yeah, sorry, it's a tough one.
No,
I mean, it's reading around it and trying to get an understanding. And it's also new. I think this is just all these questions are going to be thrown out and people are looking for these. Some will be looking for problems and some will be kind of going, yeah, okay. It's like you said, the more adoption, the more it gets used, the more that we can kind of iron these issues out.
Mm.
So only time will tell, really. But I'm getting the sense of you're a big fan. And Lindsay's skeptic is like most things. So maybe it's time to move on to the second story.
I think just one other thing that just to maybe add to this is that obviously, that, you know, this it's nice. It solves the privacy centric post third party cookie.
Does it
issues.
Though? Does it?
Oh. We hope. I mean, maybe I was just too optimistic. I would just wish that I want it to work. Mm. But I think there is also some thinking around maybe measurement. So measurement may also become a bit of an issue in terms of, like, you know, I don't think they've nailed that piece yet. And it's not to say that that can't be like ironed out or worked out. I just think it's just not been answered in this immediate phase one.
Yeah.
So that's something that might sort of also crop up.
So it's interesting. It's got opportunity, but watch this space to see how it evolves.
Yeah, because I read somewhere actually that the measurement, because someone was complaining, I think actually it was a comment from the IAB event that someone said, this is great and we're really happy with it, but actually the measurement piece is what still keeps me up at night, and that's what was concerning me most. And the feed, like I read some comments on that, people's just feedback on LinkedIn and stuff that was like, well, sure, but that's not what this is supposed to be or do. Mm. Like they might get there down the line, but actually this is a niche kind of point solution at this time. And you know, the measurement piece is a whole other ball game and a whole other aspect of the industry that does need tackling, but don't expect SDA to be the one to do it. Is that fair?
Oh, I'd say yeah, but what would I know?
Well, I don't know either. So
I'm just going to say yeah, too, because like...
And all of this is, you know, there's a massive kind of caveat that this is a discussion. This is us bringing to light what's going on in the industry. Mm. We're not pretending that we're experts and we've got all the answers. It's just kind of having a discussion around what is keeping people awake at night and how are we trying to improve our industry.
Yeah, hopefully the industry comes together to tackle the measurement piece. No, it's not just one sole area or one, you know, organisation. Hopefully it's everybody, because it's in everyone's interest, right? So
definitely.
Yeah. A problem shared is a problem halved.
And what a big problem it is. There's plenty to go around. Okay, story two. I'd like to talk about how YouTube misses revenue expectations as digital media marketing spend waivers. That's the headline. And it really is looking at how YouTube fell short of quarterly revenue expectations, reporting growth of 14% rather than the 25% predicted. This is according to data from Street Account. YouTube reported ad revenue of $6.8 billion. Now, missing Wall Street expectations and representing a slowdown in growth after they experienced a major boom in ad revenue during their earlier parts of the pandemic. So the results reflects the reversal of digital media advertising market's fortune in the current climate, where inflation and uncertainty amidst the conflict in Ukraine and cost of living crisis, among other things globally, have seen a reversal of the positive growth achieved during the height of the pandemic. Having said that, the picture is different for rival platform TikTok, for example, whose ad revenue is expected to triple to $11 billion this year. In an attempt to get a piece of the short form video pie, YouTube has released shorts, but this has yet to bear fruit. So what I'm curious to understand and get your thoughts on, ladies, is, and I'm going to come to you first, Lindsay, what do you think is causing advertisers to pull back from digital media platforms, and in particular YouTube, perhaps, on this occasion?
I mean, I think from YouTube's perspective, I mean, the war in Ukraine is taking the brunt of the blame here, which, you know, obviously Google have shut off operations in Russia. But from YouTube's revenue perspective, I think I read that Russia comprises about 1% of total revenue. So that's still a tiny chunk versus the loss they've received in ad revenue in the past quarter. But of course, like, as you mentioned, cost of living crisis, and there's everything else as well. And there are advertisers pulling back from advertising in general because of concerns around, is it the right time? Should I be doing this? Where should my money go? When should I be? Am I advertising on the right platforms? There's challenges around brand safety and brand suitability and disinformation as well. Not disinterest, it's definitely a lot of interest. But all these different concerns will cause advertisers to be reticent and go, actually, I might pull back and go into, you know, I guess the more tried and tested formats. And YouTube has come under fire in the past for not being necessarily the most trusted of platforms out there because of brand suitability issues. And anything that relates to kind of anything war related, YouTube and platforms like it are normally the first ones to take the hit, because advertisers go, this is easy for us to switch off. We can literally go on a platform and turn it off and pause all campaigns. There's no kind of, like, you know, pre-buying of stuff. There's no, it's very, very easy to turn off, but also it's the first thing, it's the first port of call where people might become under fire for advertising against the wrong kind of content. But what I find fascinating about this more generally is, you mentioned TikTok there, what I find really interesting is, you know, TikTok have destroyed the attention span and proven that nobody can concentrate on anything for more than 30 seconds, in fact, 10 seconds. But also TikTok are trying to do what YouTube are trying to do. So TikTok are trying to get into longer videos, and YouTube are trying to get into shorter videos. So YouTube Shorts, while it's not kind of like borne much fruit yet, it did announce it's received over, how many, five trillion views so far, which is, that was last month, I think, which is insane, really, given it only launched in September 2020. But it's still not going to be able to compete with TikTok for probably quite a while, because everyone is still kind of in TikTok mode. You know, Instagram launched, what was it called? IGTV. That was sunsetted last month. That's not going to, that's not got a future, because they were trying to court TikTok creators and advertisers, and they were like, no, we're happy where we are. But the interesting thing for me is TikTok, despite the fact that it's still absolutely storming it, is trying to launch 10-minute videos. And many creators are saying, well, that's great and all, but most of our TikTok audience haven't got that kind of attention span. And also, you make advertising on the TikTok platform very, very challenging. The beauty of YouTube as a content creator is you can run companion ads outside of the actual video frame itself. And that is a great way of being able to monetize your content, as well as have clickable links in the videos. If I'm selling a product, I can click on the link and take me to the page where I can buy the product. In TikTok, you can't do that yet. everything is still very much click on my link in my bio, a bit like Instagram. And that is a challenge for if you're trying to do long form content and sell something, TikTok creators are saying this is not going to work. You need to allow us to actually have clickable links, have more kind of ad format possibility, ad inventory around the video platform or kind of within the video itself for us to actually be able to monetize a 10-minute video. So I don't know how TikTok are going to do this. I don't know. I'm interested as to why they feel they need to, given YouTube are losing revenue. I don't know. The whole thing is fascinating how everybody wants what the other person has. At the same time, you know, everyone's still doing pretty well. Like, YouTube haven't done terribly, let's be honest.
I know. Yeah, sorry. Only 14%.
Yeah.
My heart goes out to them. Before I come to you, Jen, what are TikTok doing? I did read that they're launching ads on top videos and offering revenue share for creators. So that's probably a play there. But before we dig into that, Jen, I'm keen to hear your thoughts on what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, well, I think maybe, you know, they just didn't get their numbers forecasted correctly.
being like really you said, greedy.
I mean, you know, you can't maintain that level of growth. You know, the pandemic that was very favorable to them and they did really well out of that. I think, you know, it's a crowded market, right? You know, there's a lot of competition. So obviously in the mobile space, you've got TikTok. And we've got to remember that TikTok is, you know, this new, well, it's not new, but, you know, relatively new compared to YouTube. And that's where all the Gen Zs are. And I think, you know, Google is also sort of struggling to innovate in some ways, because obviously it's this big, big, gigantic juggernaut, which is beholden to shareholders. So, yeah, there's a lot of restrictions to some degree on what they can and can't do. I do think that can stifle innovation, whereas obviously TikTok's privately owned and they have got a lot more freedom in what they can do. And I think the other thing that's quite interesting is that, as prices go up, you're absolutely right. Advertising is often the first thing that tends to get cut, or they reevaluate where their budgets could go, and they want to make them work a lot harder and they want them to be more efficient. And I think actually a lot of advertisers also are looking towards premium content. So, you know, they're looking for more premium content and they can get that through streaming services, you know, not other than just, you know, UGC. So there's a lot more competition with those streaming services. And I think, you know, with CTV, obviously advertisers now have this amazing opportunity to really invest and have their ads around premium content. You know, you've got great publishers like Warner Brothers Discovery and Paramount and a whole plethora of other streaming services that are all in competition for, you know, those budgets. And actually at the New Video Frontiers last Thursday, which was great. It's great to see everybody and some great content there. But one of the questions that was asked actually was that, you know, where are all the CTV budgets coming from? And, you know, they're not just coming from linear. They're also coming from social media budgets and digital budgets. So, you know, there's a lot more sort of efficiencies and targeting capabilities with the use of data. So, again, that's also, you know, taking some of that budget away from Google, which is a good thing. This is for me.
Definitely.
I feel this is a really good story.
It's healthy,
right?
A bit of competition.
Totally.
Down to Google.
But maybe the TikToks and the Google YouTubes of the world are looking at the social element as well. And there's going to be a fight now, because I think with the TikTok pulse, creators with at least 100,000 followers on TikTok would be allowed to participate in this program, which is where the rev share comes into play. Now, of course, it's not clear what the rev share would look like, but marketers would be able to purchase ads next to the top videos across 12 categories, and that's of course the beauty, the fashion, the cooking and gaming. So that's kind of interesting. But then on the flip side, I think it was at the upfronts last week in the US, apparently YouTube execs are placing a big bet on live shopping and other commerce integrations with creators. So I think it was the VP Americas is just her title, a lady called Tara Wolpert-Levy. She was talking about how multi-commerce is one of the things that they've been taking some time to figure out in terms of how, you know, the way to match, because YouTube is already, in their opinion, and probably agreed by many, a huge part of offline commerce. She says that there are thousands of creators already experimenting with much more regular VOD-driven shopping. So they're kind of asking us to stay tuned on that. And it's a big bet for them. They're excited about it. But of course, there is no actual detail disclosed, no specifics were actually shared. But I suppose it's really kind of, it's believed that they're pursuing a more direct tie-in to the videos and that experience for the creators outside of affiliate links, which are currently run by outside companies. So there's a lot. They're looking in different areas. They're concerned from the TikToks. Like you said, Jen, there's lots of other competition. There's money's moving around. But I just wonder how they're going to do it, because I don't know what innovation is really there, apart from they just like to go out and buy companies and take market share. But how, you know, is that going to be able to continue? I don't know. Any thoughts?
Well, they might get broken up still. There's still US senators are backing them breaking up the ad rev side of the business. So that could be something. But I think that you're right. Like, actually, if they're going to succeed in shopping, they're going to buy it rather than build it fundamentally. Absolutely. It's probably going to happen.
And that's where it's got to go, right? Because ultimately, what I think we forget, people are, all this is about selling stuff or getting people to buy stuff, individuals. So it's having all this kind of fantastic, creative and engaging content, or whether it's, you know, 3 minutes or 10 minutes. I'm curious to know, you know, YouTube shifts. Does this mean short form content is the key to user attention, or are they doing this in terms of a response to TikTok? I think you're right, Lindsay, kind of the attention. I don't think it's fair to blame TikTok kind of for killing our attention span. I'm sure you could throw...
I totally disagree with that.
Do you? Go on, tell us more.
Oh, my God. Well, I just think they have absolutely killed my children's attention span. It's crack cocaine, and I have...
Hang on, listeners. Jen's kids are not on crack cocaine. Does that clear that up?
But it is the crack cocaine of social media. And TikTok is just... you know, they just swipe, 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 swipe. Like, they have got no attention span, and it is soul destroying. And it's a constant battle to get them to have an interest in anything else, you know, that holds their attention for any more than a second, really. I do blame them for that. So wow. as a parent.
I was going to blame COVID, but you know.
Well, there was that too. But I've had adults say that TikTok has killed their attention span. They're like, I cannot concentrate on things now because I'm used to seeing everything in 10-second bursts. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, it's highly addictive. I mean, it keeps you there. It does. And the more you feed it, the more it like feeds you. So, yeah.
The insatiable beast of social media. You can use that as a headline if you want. Anyone? It's out there.
You heard it here first. Before I get a little bit depressed thinking about poor Jen's kids and her work-life balance and her family life, I'm going to move on to the next story, because I mean, it's not really going to take us away from it, I'm afraid. But the third story is about Elon Musk emphasizes free speech in Twitter takeover. So I think you're either on TikTok in some weird place or under a rock if you haven't read or heard about how Elon Musk's emphasis on ensuring freedom of speech on Twitter has sparked speculation over the future of the platform, with some wondering whether advertisers will leave the social media site if changes are made to how it is moderated. Critics have expressed their fear that the new owner's vision for the platform could end up undoing Twitter's past efforts to create a safe space by drawing more bullying, disinformation and harassment. Now, such an environment would naturally deter advertisers, as we've been talking about just previously, in terms of brand suitability, etc. Why would they want to be perceived as funding an arena where hate speech, conspiracy theories and perhaps other inflammatory speech is unchecked? Other commentators point out that fewer content restrictions could mean there's a smaller audience to pitch to anyway. Many people already steer clear of Twitter because of its more public and consequently sometimes more confrontational format. And it's likely that more will depart from the platform if it becomes riddled with offensive and dangerous views. However, Musk's declaration that he intends to authenticate all humans who use Twitter could dampen fears over how the platform's free speech future will pan out. Jen, do you think this means that advertisers would potentially pull away from Twitter if Musk makes changes to how it is moderated? And will users actually stay on board overall?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. So I think potentially, yes. I mean, it will absolutely give advertisers the jitters, especially with all the work that they have put in place over the last few years to really try and improve that brand safety. And I think also, you know, on the user side, definitely if it becomes a really horrendous breeding ground for all this kind of online hate and everything, you know, you will see users drop off. But the former CEO, Jack Dorsey, you know, he definitely supports Musk's plans to take this back and make it private again, because, as he quoted, it was currently owned by Wall Street. And I think this goes back to kind of what I touched on earlier, is, you know, these businesses that are owned or that are publicly listed, you know, they have to, you know, they have to meet the demands of their shareholders. And I think by taking it back private, it means that it gives Musk this level of control to kind of, I say, do what he wants. But I think, and this is where it's quite interesting, I think there's a long-term vision. You know, Musk is a visionary. He very much looks into the future. And I think this is the beginning of a much longer-term plan. So a bit like the deprecation of cookies, you know, the immediate reaction is kind of like, oh, my God, the world's in a spin. What's going to happen? And I think he's about to shake things up. And you may lose users and you may also lose advertisers. But, you know, he's not a fan of advertising anyway. I know there's, it's a $4.5 billion a year advertising business, but he could probably there's probably not as much pressure for him to worry about that as much. Obviously, he's still got to pay back the debt. There's a lot of debt, but I think it buys him some time to do whatever he wants with this. And I think he also quoted, and I think this is quite interesting, he quoted that, you know, Twitter needs to go private to go through the changes that need to be made. But what are the changes? And I think this is what's really interesting. And I don't want to take this off on a tangent. But I think there's a bigger play here for Elon Musk. You know, like I said, he's a visionary. But what is that vision for social media? Currently we're sort of operating this Web 2.0 world, but he's big on Web 3. Yeah. So, you know, I think that this is his long-term gain. He's bought this platform, or, you know, when it goes through, this is going to be the platform that he's going to utilize to leverage his next level shit. And whatever that is, it's going to be around Web 3. You know, the good thing is that that's all decentralized, meaning that rather than consumers obviously accessing the internet through the likes of Google and Apple, it puts the control back in their hands. You know, they own the data, they can share that data, they can delete that data, you know. So I think he also wants to put the fun back in this. So I feel like this is very much, this is maybe how he's going to do that. It's about kind of a community and building, you know, there's going to be this big cultural shift. So I don't mean to go a bit deep, but I think long term, there's a bigger play in this.
Yeah, there's bound to be. You're right. I mean, there's much more on his agenda. Lindsay, do you think Twitter has simply become the kind of go-to public square?
Yeah, I do think that. And I think that I find Twitter it angers me every time I use it. I find it so confrontational. So even all the work that has been done over the years to make it a safer platform, you know, imagine what it was like if all those controls weren't in place, because in my opinion, it's terrible already. And I'm still amazed that many advertisers put money into it every year, frankly. But I don't know. I find Twitter a useful yet challenging platform. I think Musk going down the free speech route, obviously, you know, it's a global platform used by everybody in the world, well, for the most part, obviously certain areas, certain regions more than others. But it obviously, you know, the free speech aspect is very much a US regulation, US ruling. The constitutionally protected right to free speech is a very kind of US thing. And I think that by going down that route, he is going to make it just more difficult for anyone to have a kind of safe, normal conversation on it, which I already think is a struggle in many, many domains anyway on Twitter. But I also think that, you know, Jen raised a few interesting points there that I hadn't really thought about, actually, kind of what is Musk's long-term plan? The authenticating all humans thing I find very interesting, because I have been moaning for a long time, just because I don't like Twitter. It would be great to be able to, like you can with like a blue tick, so you know that someone's a celebrity or kind of a renowned person, to have something like a green tick, so you know the person you're speaking to is a verified human and not a bot with a fake email address or whatever else. I get it's probably resource heavy and expensive and challenging, but it can't be, you know, like you have to verify that you're a human when you create an Airbnb account. Like, it can't be that complicated to do that. At least then, you know, it doesn't matter who you're communicating with, you know, as a user of Twitter, okay, if they've got a green tick, then they're at least, if it's not got a green tick, it's a bot, fine, whatever. I don't care what I'm receiving because it's not real. Mm. It's just a random bot troll. All those kinds of things are interesting. That necessary if he's going to go down the free speech route and kind of remove everything. But I actually think that what Jen said about, you know, the kind of Web3 aspect of it and the metaverse aspect of it is really interesting, because actually, if anybody, you know, Zuckerberg's gone all in on Web3 with rebranding Facebook to Meta, I feel like Musk might want to take him on. And actually, if he was to take on Zuckerberg, who would win? And that could be what, because, you know, Twitter's a great platform to be able to build something huge. Musk lives in a Web3 world already, pretty much. Like, I don't think he's a dangerous man. He's just a bit crazy. Has bizarre ideas, but the most ingenious people in the world have always kind of had strange ideas and have been far crazier and more dangerous than he is. Actually, could he be the person to create something and really rival the kind of the power, the I can't think of the word. I'm trying to use a fancy word that's gone out of my head. But anyway, the power that the likes of Mark Zuckerberg has, maybe. That would be fascinating.
I mean, absolutely. I want to see this. I'll pay to see this.
Like Celebrity Deathmatch. Remember that show? It's a great show.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, I think, you know, you need someone big like that to be able to take on these giants, because they kind of are just doing their own thing.
It's only time will tell. And, you know, this deal is still being worked through. There's still, I think recently they announced a whole flurry of new content partnerships on the platform as it is. So when are things going to change? What's it going to look like? In the short term, they're probably going to continue with the, you know, Twitter's at the heart of advertising. And it's a desire not just to reach consumers, but to connect with them around something they care about. What is it they care about? If, you know, from Lindsay's experience, it's not great, perhaps, and sometimes it's quite confrontational. What are people on there for? Yes, it can help amplify brands, etc. Yes, they can probably rake in a shed loads more cash while they figure this out, and they're probably halfway there to figuring it out already, which is exciting. I'm looking forward to kind of see, you know, what will become of it, but even more so, how quickly can he expedite it?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because, you know, you mentioned there's content partnerships that have been created. Like, you know, that it's not unheard of that somebody will come in and everything that's been created before it, even if it had created the second they walked in, to literally be nixed and shut down and kind of forgotten about, and everything that was agreed upon to be reneged. And that could easily happen. Like, he'll come in and just, like, you know, could like a bull in the china shop and go, right, everything that's been done before is going to be not done anymore. And we're going to completely change the face of everything. He could do that. It depends who he's got around him running the business. Mm.
And that's, we don't know, right? And that's part of the deals that's going to be worked out. And that's, you know, again, it's watch this space. But it's exciting. I think it's good. I don't think he's a bad man either. And I'm with you on that, Lindsay, in terms of it. There's a, I don't know, what is it? There's a fine line between love and hate, but it's even finer between kind of madness and sanity or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, it needs someone like him to kind of take them on and challenge them and definitely shake things up. And being a private company, he can do that, and he can have that level of control. So yeah, I think it will be really interesting to see where this pans out. And, you know, along the way, there's probably going to be a lot of bumps. And, you know, I think people working at Twitter, they're either going to embrace it or they're going to hate it. So you could lose. There's always a bit of loss of staff in that whole process. But yeah, I think it's interesting. This is a really interesting story.
It'd be good to see as well in other parts, you know, of the world. This is very US-centric. and what's happening in other regions. There's probably other platforms. Well, we know there are other platforms, but what are they doing? There's probably smaller, more innovative companies coming through that will challenge them as well. And hopefully it won't be just a case of, oh, yes, well, we'll buy them. They're really good. So let's just buy them. And actually genuinely kind of put people first and give us that platform in a safe, measurable way that doesn't turn into crack cocaine for your kids. But anyway.
I mean, he wants to give internet to all parts of the world, right? And he's got the ability to do that with, I think, is it Starlink or these things that can, place and give areas of the world that don't yet have internet. And again, he's got a platform, hasn't he?
Yes.
So it could all tie in quite nicely with all the other areas of his business that he has as well. So I think,
and that's probably definite... why you don't need to advertise on Twitter, because your sponsor is starting to go up into the river it goes.
Yeah.
And then you can bring light to people in the Ukraine who don't have any power, for example. You know what I mean? There's just... And that's the bit I believe in him. I don't know why, but I do believe there's something that I feel that he will actually do some greater good in and amongst everything else. I don't know. Anyway, we've run out of time on that, but it does mean that we've got time to go into the second part of the podcast, which is where we get to find out more about you, Jen, and what you're up to, and in particular, what's happening with the Women in Programmatic Network.
Yeah. So, for those that don't know much about the Women in Programmatic, I'll quickly give a brief update. But it is what it, as it says, it is, women in programmatic. And the aim is to really support women, in our industry across all areas. So that's publisher side, agency, advertiser, and ad tech, and at all levels. And I think this is what really differentiates us. Is that we, our network consists of women of all levels, so from junior all the way to senior. And the nice thing about that is that, it gives junior people to the ability to sort of connect with senior people, have conversations, feel inspired, and for senior people to really give back and support those junior people. And it started in 2019. It was just a few of us, a handful of us that just came together to talk tech and talk programmatic. And it's just grown. And I think the pandemic has really accelerated that. I think we timed it right without really knowing where this was going to go. And we now have over 600 women registered as members.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's global, right?
It is. It's global. And we touch all corners of the world. I mean, I host a monthly session and literally there's women dialing in from everywhere, from the US, from Israel, from everywhere. And I think that's what's really nice. There's no barriers. Nothing kind of stops you from being part of that. Obviously, in Australia, it's a bit more challenging with time zones. So we've even launched a regional hub out in Australia. So we have another Women in Programmatic group there, and they kind of run it in the same way that we run it here. And we will look at, we're in the process of launching that in other local countries, the likes of Germany and maybe France, because you've got the language barrier. English is not always everyone's first language. And also, the markets are different as well. So that's on the cards. But yeah, it was founded by Emily Roberts and Sophie Toth. And then there's three other members, which is Nikki Channa and Emily Palmer and myself. So five of us. And we have a really active WhatsApp group. We've nearly hit the 200 quota. So we're, going to have to work out what we do after that. But we've been absolutely overwhelmed by all the support. I mean, you guys are amazing. You supported us along the way. And I think, we have also tried to help support you finding female speakers. As an industry, this is a big, big problem. And likewise, you've supported us with enabling women to be able to attend your events and what have you. So we are hugely grateful for that continued support. And, back in March, we did our sort of second face-to-face networking event, which was the International Women's Day event. And we got 200 people to attend that, which is massive. I mean, you always have that sort of nervous feeling of how many people are going to come, because we had to oversubscribe. So it was either going to go one way or the other, but we hit it bang on. But that was full of amazing female speakers. The content was brilliant. And we had a really great blend of all genders as well. So it wasn't just all women. And, you know, I have to say thanks to Xander, who sponsored the speakers, and obviously Taboola, who opened their offices and hosted the event. So that was a big thing for us. And that went really, really well. And also, I mean, we're now officially a non-profit organization. So that's pretty cool.
Congratulations.
Indeed, congratulations.
Yeah, and I think that just means that we can now do a lot more with the partners that we want to work with, and we can, it enables us to kind of receive donations and be able to put that to good work. For example, you know, putting together a speaker bureau where we can offer training to our members, again, to help the industry, to help women have a greater voice and feel comfortable to get out there and speak at events. The other big thing that's happening in July, June, is Cannes. I'm very excited.
Well, it's not the only big thing happening in June.
Well, yes. Sorry, oh my God.
How could you?
Oh, God. ATS,
for listeners, after ATS London, a few people will skirt off to the south of France, drink some rosé. That's okay.
Oh no, I'm sorry. Yes, obviously ATS. How could I forget?
Oh, well, it's okay, Jen. It's all right.
The only reason
that's
I'm
exciting.
Excited,
tell us about what's going on in Cannes.
Is because I've not been to Cannes. Well, I have been, but not through work, through as in a work thing. So I'm quite excited to experience Cannes. I've heard a lot of amazing stories. But yeah, PwC have very kindly offered us a slot on a yacht.
So we
have a panel. It's on the Tuesday, the 21st, and it's at 4 p.m. So if there are any female women out there that would like to come and listen in, please get in touch with me, because we'll be issuing tickets out for that event. But that's really exciting.
That's amazing.
I know. Big, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to be talking about yet?
Yeah, so it's all centered around kind of whether blockchain is the future of digital advertising. So it's kind of like a sexy subject. So that's something to really look forward to. And then we've got some other sort of projects on the go. And again, I sort of spoke about the fact that, you know, the big reason why I kind of was part of this was it's all about giving back. So, you know, when I was at Dennis Publishing and I got made redundant, I'd been there a long time, I kind of got dumped by my work husband. And it's tough, right? You're a bit institutionalized when you kind of like go out into the you know, the open market, and it's a bit like the dating game. It's like, oh my gosh, I need to go for some interviews, go for some dates. Yeah. And, you know, they don't always work out, or like, you know, it was a bit nervous for me. But my network is absolutely what supported me. And I do go on about this to everybody. Your network is your most valuable asset. And so I really wanted to kind of make sure that I could give back and help others. So we are also looking at my like next generation of digital professionals, and really helping so school leavers and grads to get into the industry. And I think there really is a job for everybody, which also, you know, I don't think they realize that, right? So that's quite a bit of a passion of mine, and helping back. And the other thing that we have just done is launch a parents in programmatic group. So we are
just in case you don't have enough time in your day to talk about programmatic.
There's one for parents. No, I think this is a really important one, because, you know, a lot of us are parents, and it's a massive juggling act to kind of, you know, spin all the plates and keep everything spinning without anything breaking. And it's hard to sometimes get the balance right. And, you know, it definitely was tough in the early days. I think working from home has made a huge difference. You don't have that sense of guilt as much. And there's so much more flexibility. So I think it's really important that businesses get behind and support all their employees, male and female, around this. And so we're kicking off with some research. Maybe I can share a link for any of your listeners to fill in. I'm sure a lot of them will be parents, and we'll have some, you know, great information that they could share for that survey.
Definitely. So, yeah. Sounds great. So you're busy, and that's all on top of the day job.
That is, you know, I love my job at Magnite. Magnite is, I feel, again, like I found, you know, the funny thing about this, right? And I liken this to dating was obviously when I joined as Talaria, I found my perfect partner and I didn't have to go on loads of dates as in, you know, and then obviously Magnite was formed through the merger between Rubicon and Talaria. Now that to me is an arranged marriage and I never signed up for that. So it worked out beautifully. The people there were amazing and I do feel very fortunate to be working with such amazing people. They are really fun to work with. They're very collaborative and I love it. I love my job. So I'm back in love again.
Good.
Which is a good thing.
You got over the 7-year itch and it's all 100 days again. Excellent.
There is a 7-year itch, by the way.
That's for offline conversation. Because sadly, that's all we've got time for today. But really, thank you so much, Jen, for taking the time to have a chat with us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'd love to be on this.
Brilliant. And Lindsay, as always, thank you for being a guest.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
And thank you to our listeners. That's it. That's another episode of the Exchange Wire Mad Tech Podcasts.